Welcome to Canada's most irreverent talk show. This is The Andrew Lawton Show, brought to you by True North.
Hello and welcome to you all. This is Canada's most irreverent talk show here, The Andrew Lawton Show on True North on this Tuesday, March 26th. I want to give you just on a programming note, because coming up in about a week and one day, the Canada Strong and Free Networking Conference will be once again taking place in Ottawa at the Westin Hotel. Yours truly will be doing his show live from the, basically live from the hallway, which doesn't sound luxurious or anything, but we have a True North booth that we'll have there once again, and we'll be doing live shows over the course of the conference. It should be a lot of fun, and I'm also going to be on stage. It was just announced this week, doing one-on-one fireside chats with Danielle Smith, the Premier of Alberta, who I've had on the show a number of times. I used to work with her and guest host for her. I know Premier Smith very well. And I'll also be doing one with New Brunswick Premier Blaine Higgs. Now, I don't actually know Premier Higgs. I've never spoken to him. I've never met him, but I am honored to be able to do the on-stage interview. Certainly, we'll be talking about parental rights. I suspect the carbon tax will also come up. And if there are any other questions you want to hear from either Premier Smith or Premier Higgs on, please do let us know in the comments. We will, we won't ask the dumb ones, but we'll try to, you know, come up with the good ones, and then I'll just take credit for them on stage. It's actually the interviewer's prerogative. So, nevertheless, that is going to be in a week and a half. Now, I don't know if we're going to be able to show the full interviews on the Andrew Lawton Show. So if you want to get the full experience, definitely come in person if you're going to be in Ottawa, or you like to travel to Ottawa, or you're willing to tolerate Ottawa, which I won't tell you where I am on that one. But also we will, I have another event coming up, but I'll tell you about that later on, because it's not for a few weeks and it's also in Ottawa. So I don't want to start galvanizing. It's the only place that I'm booked to speak, apparently. But we will be talking later on in this show about the ballooning size of government, speaking of Ottawa, and as we know, it is getting much, much too big. We'll also be talking about this controversy in a British Columbia city where it's actually quite interesting here. They have decided to, they're deciding to twist themselves into knots because they were exposed to a set of opinions they didn't like. And those opinions are contained in a book that True North actually published called Grave Error. We'll have Tom Flanagan on the program. Oh, there you go. Tom Flanagan, one of the co-editors of that book, will be on very shortly to talk about what's going down in the city of Quesnel, British Columbia. I hope I'm saying that right, or if not, that you'll correct me. And by the time we get to 1:30, I will be corrected and able to say it right. I'll get that Jordan Peterson re-education camp. But let's begin talking about this. One of the rare situations in which I tend to be a supporter of government ineptitude and government incompetence. It doesn't happen often. In fact, it might never happen except for on this and only this issue. But let's go back in time first. So it was May 1st, 2020. When the Liberal government imposed a sweeping order in council that banned 1,500 types of firearm overnight. It just instantly made it so that these guns, which were legally on store shelves, which were legally in gun owners' cabinets at the shooting range, could no longer be used. One of these was the often misrepresented and maligned AR-15 platform of firearm, and other non-restricted hunting guns that were used without issue and have been used by law-abiding gun owners in Canada for years, overnight are prohibited. Now, the government did not have a plan. They did not know what they were doing. They saw that there was a bit of public momentum on their side against firearms, because this was, you may recall, in the aftermath of that horrific, horrific killing spree in starting in Portapique, Nova Scotia. And the Liberals decided that they had to pounce at that moment to crack down on lawful firearms owners. Now, they do this, and of course we learned that the guy did not legally have guns. He was not legally authorized to own them. He had imported his guns illegally from the United States, and they were not coming out of the legal civilian market in Canada. None of that mattered to the Liberals. They just wanted to say that guns were the problem, and that this measure, which only targets the law-abiding gun owners in the country, would somehow be justifiable. So that was May 2020. No, it was a very aggressive plan. They said these guns are prohibited, but we're putting a two-year amnesty period in place. So if you legally own an AR-15, you actually get to keep that for 2 years while we put together this buyback program. Buyback. This is the language the government uses. As though the gun was once theirs to begin with, they will just buy it back from you. That's all. We're supposed to believe that it's going to be fair market value and all that. But as it happened, there was no buyback. There is no buyback. There has never been a single gun bought back, nor, for that matter, has there been a firearm confiscated under this program. Yet, as we learned, I got it from Brian Passafume in the National Post, but it actually came from an order paper question in the House of Commons, or the Senate, rather. The government has spent $42 million. On a buyback program that doesn't exist. They have spent $42 million and with that have not purchased, confiscated, acquired, destroyed, relocated, adopted. They have not touched a single firearm under this program. And they have spent $42 million to do it. So this is not in the cost of the guns themselves. This is just in the bureaucracy and management and maintenance of a program that does not exist. Now, as a taxpayer, I think this is egregious. As a taxpayer, I think it's offensive. I think it's destructive. As a gun owner, I'm kind of happy about this. I actually love the idea that the government has not in 4 years been able to do this, that the government has not actually in 4 years managed to collect a single firearm, because that is exactly the problem here. The government is trying to do something that is not going to amount to a hill of beans when it comes to real gun crime. So there are no victims when we talk about the lawful gun owners who would never hurt a fly, who would only, well, maybe they'd hurt a fly if it's, you know, fly season, but they never hurt a human. They never break the law. They're so diligent about their regulations and how they have to store the guns. We all are, because we don't want our guns to be taken away, our property to be seized. We don't want to be criminally charged. The stakes are very high if you are a licensed gun owner in this country and you screw up. And the reality is that the people that comply with regulations are the people who are not breaking the law. It's not, as we talk about time and time again, the case that the guns picked up on the streets after some gang shootout in Surrey or Toronto were coming from the civilian market. In fact, they were coming from organized crime. They were smuggled in across the border. Some of them were stolen, but most of them are coming across the longest unprotected border in the world, which we share with a country that has much wider access to firearms. And the idea that we can in Canada regulate away gun crime without dealing with gun crime at the border is absurd, but it's what the federal government has tried to do. So as a result, they spend $42 million. Taxpayers in this country are the ones forced to pick up that bill. Legal gun owners are the ones who will eventually be targeted by this. And one of the core problems here is that the government presented this. I didn't want to force you to listen to Bill Blair, so we didn't pull the Bill Blair clip. But when he presented this, and when Justin Trudeau presented this, they used language that was very extreme, as though there was a crisis, as though every day these guns were out in the country, people were losing their lives. These guns, Trudeau said, were designed to kill as many people as possible, as quickly as possible. That was a near direct quote of Justin Trudeau. If it was that dire, and if they pose that much of an emergency and that much of a public safety risk, you wouldn't think the government would drag its heels for 2 years to do something about it. We saw in the COVID era, also in 2020, by the way, how swiftly government can move when it feels it has to. Now, that doesn't mean it makes the right calls, but they're capable of moving quickly when they want to. Now, in this case, maybe they're not. Is it that they're trying to just delay it so that they can campaign on it in the next election? Quite possibly. Or is it that they are just woefully inept? It's always that divide in government of, do you attribute it to malice or incompetence, or is it malicious incompetence, which I think increasingly describes things that our government does. I wanted to share with you a brief clip because I did a documentary about this in 2021. So it came out just a year after the order in council. And at the time, there were already grave concerns about the effect this was having on firearms businesses. Take a look.
How is a business like yours supposed to operate when anything that you sell could one day be illegal?
On eggshells. Take it a day at a time.
I visited Jeff's store 1 year after the Liberals' order in council.
And there in his warehouse were tens of thousands of dollars of now prohibited firearms. They're illegal to sell or to use and cannot even be sold back to the government despite the promise of a buyback. It's a rule of retail. If you're not moving inventory, you're losing money. Something felt by a lot of the gun store owners I heard from is that this is a feature, not a bug, of the Liberals' gun measures.
You know, we're sitting on inventory right now that we can't sell, and that's tying up a lot of dollars, which in retail is a cardinal sin. The biggest sin in retail is not to turn your inventory over. So, you know, it's created some financial hardship, but I try not to complain about it too much because I know I'm not alone. I know that every other business, whether you're a wholesaler or a distributor in the country, has been affected. I liken it to the automotive industry. And imagine you own a car lot and Environment Canada walks onto your lot one day and says, we're banning V8s. And by the way, you can't sell them. They have to sit on your lot. And maybe someday, 2 or 3, maybe 4 years down the road, we might pay you cost, we might pay you retail, or it just might be a flat amount we're going to give you. But in the meantime, all the parts that you have for them and your vehicles are tied up. So as retailers and wholesalers, that's where we're at right now. Our inventory is tied up. We can't sell it. Your entire business model has been destroyed. And there's a lot of people out there, unfortunately, in this country who are in that situation right now because of the OIC.
That last gentleman was Scott Carpenter, who is the owner of International Shooting Supplies in Surrey. And one thing that I mentioned Surrey earlier, Surrey, BC has incredible, incredible issues with organized crime. You've got gang fights there. You've got issues with shooting. And those issues do not have anything to do with firearms that are sold on the shelves of International Shooting Supplies. Quite the contrary, those are the guns going to people that are interested in sport shooting, collecting, hunting. They are firearms that are used by people who have nothing to do and actually deplore the issues with organized crime in their community. And once again, when government says we listen to the experts, they're not interested in the law enforcement experts, they're not interested in the firearms experts, they're not interested in all of the people who have universally pretty much come out, except for a narrow subset who are activists committed to ending civilian gun ownership in Canada. They don't listen to the people who are saying, hey, you're not going to do anything about crime. But the government knows, the Liberals know, that firearms restrictions play well in the polls. They know that overwhelmingly, Canadians are not gun owners. Gun owners represent, I think, about 2 million people in this country. I don't know what the adult population is specifically, but it is a minority of Canadians that own guns. Of the people who don't, some are sympathetic to gun owners, married to a gun owner, others are indifferent, and others are hell-bent against guns. But it's a group that is not itself a sizable enough voting bloc to sway elections most of the time. And we also see the government really love to just stoke those fears. They use misinformation, loaded language like assault rifle, assault weapons, things that the average person doesn't really understand are loaded. And they do this. So I'm convinced that, yes, there's probably some bureaucratic incompetence here, but the Liberals are also wanting to extend this debate, protract this debate, so that it comes up in the polls once again, and they can go into their old bag of tricks and say that, oh, the evil, scary boogeyman conservatives with their gun fetish are the problem. That's going to be the Liberal government's strategy. You can take that to the bank. I mean, don't cash it for a couple of years until you know I'm right, but that's the check. You can probably cash that in a couple of years, and who knows with inflation what it'll be worth. But speaking of which, we'll talk about the ballooning size of government, and it's actually a rather natural segue, because government tends to just spend money that it doesn't have, that isn't its own, and not do it in a particularly efficient way. I mentioned that they've spent $42 million without confiscating a single gun, but you know that money is going towards staff. They're administering a bureaucracy. They're commissioning reports. They're doing all of this stuff that government does that private sector enterprise would never want to do, nor would it be able to get away with doing it. But it times well with this report that came out from the Fraser Institute just on how large government has gotten. And this is not just a federal problem, but you see it at the provincial level as well. A new study says that from 2007 to 2022, government spending in 8 out of 10 provinces, so 80% of the country in terms of provinces, and went up. Government spending increased in these provinces, and also public sector employment rose, not just in 8 out of 10, but rose across the board in all provinces. So government is getting fatter and more costly, even if we have a lot of economic situations in that that would not necessarily support such growth. Jake Fuss is back with us. He is the Fiscal Studies Director for the Fraser Institute. Jake, always good to have you on. Thanks for coming back today.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
So just to talk about what is at stake here and what you're seeing, is this the normal growth to keep up with growth in the country, or is this a disproportionate growth that you're tracking here?
Yeah, what we're seeing is that the size of government as measured by spending is growing faster than the Canadian economy, like you mentioned, in 8 out of 10 provinces, but also nationally. So when we're looking at local, provincial, and federal levels of government, we're now seeing government spending representing more than 40% of the Canadian economy, whereas it was about 37% in 2007. So there's been a pretty substantial increase in government spending as a share of the economy over the last 15 years or so. And it's been a pretty much across the board change in all provinces across Canada, except for PEI and Saskatchewan, which saw small declines in size of government in that 2007 to 2022 period.
Do you know what it is that accounts for that, for those two?
It's a good question. There have been some changes over time. So I think some of it might have to do with some changes during the pandemic as well, because generally we were seeing, you know, Saskatchewan actually had a higher spending in 2019 than it does in 2022, for instance. So there might be some certain temporary programs being removed or other things. So we'll have to keep track of Saskatchewan and Prince Edward Island over the long run to see if this is actually a trend or just a blip on the radar. But in PEI's case, even though they had a declining size of government, their size of government is still about 58% of the size of the economy, for instance. Whereas a province like Alberta, which, yes, increased in terms of size of government, their size of government is about 27% the size of the economy. So there's a marked difference here between a lot of the provinces in Canada, especially Western provinces compared to Eastern provinces. We're generally seeing smaller governments in Western Canada relative to Eastern Canada.
Obviously, in that range, a couple of events, I think, have to be noted here. 2007 and 2022, you've got the 2008 recession, and we know that was just an example for government or of government shoving money out the door as quickly as they could. You also mentioned the pandemic, another situation in which governments were racking up insane amounts of spending. How much do those, if at all, skew the overall trajectory you're looking at?
I think they definitely have an impact. I mean, especially when you look at the 2020 COVID pandemic, for instance, you do see a huge spike in government size during that time. But what was interesting is that it basically became a permanent increase, maybe not to the levels that we saw at the height of the COVID pandemic, but we basically had a permanent increase in the size of government between 2019 and 2022. So that really tells us that, yes, COVID does have an impact, but governments are actually just increasing in size over time anyways. We had 7 out of 10 provinces increase their size of government between that 3-year period between 2019 and 2022. And of course, you know, the financial crisis in 2008 also has an impact on the size of government as well. But, you know, in the years when you're winding down temporary programs or other things, we're still seeing that permanent ramp up in government spending that really has nothing to do with the pandemic. It's just simply increased bureaucracy, increased government spending over time.
Yeah, and I was kind of curious about the public sector growth. Now, I know this study doesn't doing a public-private sector contrast, but I think we do know that private sector employment is not immune to economic trends. Private sector employers that don't have a taxpayer to lean on have to make very difficult decisions. They all slash their workforce, well, not all, but many of them slash their workforces during COVID. But we see a continual increase in, as we were talking about earlier, every single level of government, every single province here over that span.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, essentially what we've seen from 2007 to 2022 is an increased share of the workforce employed in the public sector, for instance.
So not just raw numbers, it's the share that's going up. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it's basically growing faster than private sector employment, for instance. So if we look at 2007, about 19% of total employment in Canada was in the public sector. Now in 2022, it's about 21%. And we've seen that across the board in all provinces. All 10 provinces had increases in public sector employment relative to total employment in Canada. So yes, private sector employment is still increasing over time, but it's not growing as fast as public sector employment is what these numbers show us.
One of the challenges, and I know it's going outside the scope of this study, but you can look at these numbers, and again, just to pull them out here, in Nova Scotia, government's size relative to the economy, 63%, and in Alberta, 26.8%. So, you know, even if it's going up in Alberta, it's still nowhere near the size in Nova Scotia and Atlantic Canada generally. So, if you're looking at this as a taxpayer, not an economist, and you're trying to figure out what's the sweet spot, is there a sweet spot? Is there a size that it should be or is supposed to be?
Yes. So we know from empirical research that generally the optimal size of government is generally between 26 to 30% of the size of the economy. And this is when you get historically maximizing your economic growth rates. When you start to exceed these levels, and you can actually start hindering your economy. And then you can ultimately start hindering living standards for citizens as well. So Alberta is the only province that is actually within that optimal range of 26 to 30%. All other provinces are well above 30%. In fact, most provinces are well above 40%, and some of them are even exceeding 50 or 60%. So they're well above that optimal range. And they're at that point where they're likely harming their economies and harming the living standards in those provinces as well, rather than helping the citizens by having that optimal range of government in that 26 to 30% of the size of the economy.
That's actually quite interesting. So I wasn't familiar with that that data you referenced. So basically, we do see an inverse relationship between size of government and overall economic prosperity or health.
Yeah, exactly. And that analysis is based on a whole bunch of OECD countries, very advanced countries around the world. And it's a historical analysis. You can even extend the analysis a little bit more if you want to punch it out a little bit more to about 24 to 32% of the size of the economy. But generally, what we've seen is that these countries around the world have actually maximized their growth rates when it is within that range. So it provides a good barometer for governments to actually track their progress and to ultimately see, you know, is there ways that we can actually improve economic growth? And can we address this through government spending as the size of our economy? Are we too high, too low? Are we in the optimal range? And I think that's an important metric for governments to track over the long term.
So if we took the national picture here, Canada has government at 40.5% the size of the economy. What's needed to take that down to that range that we're talking about?
Well, it's certainly a complicated question because it's not just one level of government. You know, when we're looking at the federal level of government, we also have provincial governments and local governments included in that. So really, it's a cohesive effort between all three levels of government to actually track their progress on this. Right now, we're really seeing an explosion in government spending and debt at really all levels of government. And that's certainly a concern moving forward. So I think it's going to be important and imperative for governments to begin to review the amount of spending, what they're spending on. Are we getting value for this money? Is this actually leading to economic growth? Is it leading to improved living standards for Canadians? Because right now, what we're really seeing is economic stagnation, and we're not seeing those improved living standards for Canadians. And just because we have more government spending isn't necessarily leading to better results for us. So I think we need to rethink what we're ultimately doing on government spending as a share of the economy and what we're spending this money on too.
All right. Well, fascinating numbers as always, Jake Fuss, Director of Fiscal Studies for the Fraser Institute. Thanks so much, sir.
Thanks very much for having me.
All right. We will talk to you soon as the problem is sadly not going away. One of the problems with government spending, of course, has been a question that I think goes along with government priorities. Government loves to look at ways to collect revenue, not as keen on looking at ways to stop spending. For example, the carbon tax, which I will continue beating the drum on, is going up once again on April 1st. This is an increase that the Liberals have decided to make their political hill to die on. And I think electorally speaking, it may well be the hill they die on. But let me talk about this very briefly, because the left, the pro-carbon tax lobby, is bringing out the big guns. Yes, here is an open letter. Oh, yes, an open letter from economists on Canadian carbon pricing. Yes, they're rebuffing the, and why are they rebuffing or are they rebutting? I think they're both. They're rebutting with buffery. They're rebuffing with buttery. I don't know. They are rebuffing and rebutting the carbon tax critics' claims that carbon pricing won't reduce greenhouse gas emissions, that it drives up the cost of living and is a major cause of inflation. And you can't see it in that screenshot, but underneath their rebuttal of claim two, They say, oh, well, no, you can see it at the bottom there. Oh, no, no, no. Carbon taxes, carbon pricing has caused less than 1/20th of Canada's inflation. Well, for starters, those figures are disputed, but I would also point out that it is a mechanism that is entirely optional and adds insult to injury when you are trying to get to the bottom of why the cost of living is increasing. No one has said the carbon tax is single-handedly stoking inflation. We have said that it is exacerbating it. It is aggravating it. It is doing more to basically strain Canadians' ability to spend money. And my goodness, we are finding time and time again examples of people that are trying to defend what is increasingly the indefensible. And this is why you have premiers in a majority of provinces, including Liberal leaders, Liberal Premier Andrew Fury, saying, yeah, the carbon tax is not working. It's why Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre, of all the issues he could be talking about, he right now is doing a national tour of rallies. And he, of all of these issues, is speaking on the carbon tax. That is what he's decided to make the entire focal point of his tour, of his campaign. He's doing the axe the tax, the spike the hike, the, you know, say no to the car. I was trying to think of another rhyme, but I couldn't. This is, I think, quite an interesting development. And again, he's bringing out thousands and thousands of people collectively. I don't know if this is an issue that, like, if these people would come out for anything. If he were to say this is the corned beef hash rally, if people would come out to celebrate corned beef hash just because they like Pierre Poilievre, or if they're coming out because it's a carbon tax. But we do know that there are thousands and thousands and thousands of people that online, at least, have said they are going to show up to a series of rallies that are being held across the country on April 1st. This is the day the carbon tax is, the increase is going into effect. And there's a way, I don't have the URL handy, but there's some website which is tracking basically the national network of these protests. Sean, do you have that URL by chance? I'll read it to people if they want to check it out. But there's going to be a big one in Ottawa. There's going to be a big one in Lloydminster, which one of our Alberta reporters, Isaac Lamoureux, had said, oh, I'm going to this, because he's in Edmonton. And he's like, oh, I'm going to go to this rally in Lloydminster. And I'm like, surely they're doing one in Edmonton that you could go to that's closer. He said, oh, no, no, no. And I thought he was crazy. And then I looked into it. I was, oh, no, no, no. Lloydminster is actually going to be the big giant one here. So, and Lloydminster is fun because it's a city that is half, well, I don't know half, but it's part in Saskatchewan and part in Alberta. So you get to just, like, if you're in Lloydminster, you get to just, like, have one foot in each province. And I mean, I guess you could do that anywhere on the border, but I don't know. I like Lloydminster. But the thing about it is that they're going to have a big thing there. And I think there are going to be trucks involved because everyone has a bit of a convoy spirit now. Here it is. It's a nationwide, I guess I could have just guessed the name of the website. It's Nationwide Protest Against the Carbon Tax.ca, which is they went for the most literal interpretation possible. But Nationwide Protest Against the Carbon Tax.ca. And again, I don't even know who's involved with this, so I'm not endorsing the individual people. But if you look at the map, you've got, let me just see, there's one in Vancouver, there's one in Lucerne, BC, which I'm not as familiar with. You've got a couple in southern Alberta, one in Coleman, one in Highway 1 and 22 Interchange, which is perhaps not the name of the town. Lloydminster, Cypress County, all of these great, great places. Well, I've never been to some of them, but I'm assuming they're great places. If the people are assembling to fight the carbon tax, these are surely great places. And then in Toronto, and a lot of convoy spirit here. A lot of these are not just individual locations. These are our roots. But the point is that Canadians have been, this has been a galvanizing issue for Canadians. Canadians have been keen to get involved and are incredibly, incredibly frustrated with what the government is doing. So I mean what I said, this will be the hill that the government wants to die on. And electorally, I think it very much will. So we'll certainly keep tabs on that. And we've got reporters covering in at least three cities, the carbon tax protest going on Monday. But send in your footage, send in your photos, your videos, if you're at one of these, and let us know what is going on there. I want to turn our attention to a controversy in British Columbia, where a city council is reeling after people in the community were exposed to heterodox views. The setting for this is the city of Quesnel, where the mayor's wife decided to hand out to some people copies of a book that was, as it happened, published by True North. The book is called Grave Error. It was written, well, it was edited by CP Champion and Professor Tom Flanagan. It features a number of essays from some incredibly esteemed scholars and contributors that are talking about Canadian history, a version of Canadian history that you aren't really getting, even though it is a version that is supported by volumes and volumes of evidence. So it's put in a book that was a bestseller on Amazon, has sold thousands of copies, but has been blacklisted by several libraries, and as it happened, is now facing this ridiculous investigation, inquiry, apology by a city council. Tom Flanagan joins me now. Tom, always good to talk to you. Thanks for coming on, and congratulations for all the success of the book, too.
Well, thanks, Andrew.
So what on earth happened in this British Columbia community?
Well, the mayor's wife, her name is Pat Morton. She's I don't know what her professional designation is, but her business is filing tax returns. She read the book. She liked it. So she bought 10 copies and was giving them to people or places where she thought it might do some good. There are four small Indian bands in the area around the town of Quesnel, and they heard of what was going on, that she was giving out these books. So they sent a letter to city council, said they wanted to meet to discuss the book. So they showed up, and basically they bullied the council into voting to condemn the book, even though none of them had ever read the book. They all said, no, we haven't read it. First time we've seen it, but we'll vote to condemn it anyway. Then the same thing happened with the school board. Pat had given a copy to the school board. All this took place without the knowledge of myself or any of the other authors. She just did it on her own. So the school board voted to condemn it as well. I still don't know if anybody's actually read the book out there.
Even some of the comments you hear are basically from people saying, well, I started reading it and I didn't like it, or I heard so-and-so said this was offensive. When I first heard of this controversy, distributed in the community, it sounded like someone had bought the entire inventory on Amazon and was just like going out distributing them door to door. And then you learn, as you've just shared, that a woman who liked the book bought a handful of copies and handed them out. And I still fail to see how this is a city council matter.
Well, it's because she's the wife of the mayor, I guess.
Which has no official, there's no first lady of Quesnel. She has no official status with the city,
course,
as I understand.
Of course
it.
Not, but they claim that because mm-hmm. she's married to the mayor that it makes a difference. I should say in passing that the whole ruckus has been a boost for our sales of the book. You can track not the actual number of sales, but you can track your ranking on the Amazon website of where you stand relative to other books. And we shot up over 90 places in the books category once this happened. We had slipped down below 100, and the next day we shot up to 7. So, it's been great for us.
Well, fair enough. You can embrace the silver lining of that, Tom. But let me ask you about kind of the context here, because one of the terms that has been used in coverage of this even, and certainly CBC's narrative on what happened in Quesnel, is that this is residential school denialism. And they basically make claims about the book, or they make claims about what the book says that the book doesn't actually say.
No. Much of the book is devoted to examining the announcement that came out of Kamloops, the notorious announcement about 215 unmarked graves. We also look at a couple of other similar announcements as well, like the one from Blue Quills. There have been multiple from Blue Quills, but we looked at one of them that was available at the time, and some others as well. Trying to look at actual evidence. The first thing to understand is that there is no physical evidence of unmarked graves. The only evidence, if you could call it that, is the results of ground-penetrating radar, which at best can show soil disturbances or soil anomalies. It doesn't tell you what's there. In order to know what's there, you have to dig. And there have been a few digs around the country, most recently at Pine Creek Reserve, on the border between Saskatchewan and Manitoba, in the basement of the Mission Church there. Didn't find anything. None of the digs have turned up any, you know, no bones, no shrouds, no caskets, nothing that could be linked to a burial. Absolute absence of physical evidence. I'm not saying that no child was ever buried near a residential school. You can't say that, but I think the burden of proof is on the other side to say, yeah, there were burials, and they haven't come forward with any evidence that is at all persuasive. But they just demand that you believe on the basis of a combination of ground-penetrating radar and memories. At this point, these memories are really quite old schools. The last school shut down in 1996, but most of them were shut down long before that. So when you're hearing memories, they're usually actually something that somebody heard from his father or his grandfather. It could be 60, 70, even 100 years old. So they're demanding that you believe this, and if you don't believe it, you're called a denialist. We're not denying anything. We're just saying, show us the evidence. So that's a big part of the book, is looking at these claims about unmarked graves. Now, related to that is the claim about missing children. This is a related claim. These unmarked graves supposedly hold the bodies of of the missing children. But just as there are no unmarked graves, there are no missing children. The children were all carefully accounted for in the schools. They had to be, because the government was paying a per capita payment to the religious bodies that ran the schools, and the government wasn't going to fork over money without some evidence that the kids were there. So, and the churches weren't going to let the kids go missing, because they needed to proffer the evidence so they could continue to get the money. So there are no missing children. Again, these allegations have been made. Excuse me, Andrew, I'm getting over a cold, and it's not the greatest, but I'm doing the best I can. Did children die at schools? Well, absolutely. Most of this took place before there was a cure for tuberculosis, and tuberculosis was rampant. In all of Canada, actually, but particularly in Native communities. It was probably worse on the reserves than in the schools, but it was bad enough in the schools. And yes, kids died, but there are death certificates that you can get from the Department of Vital Records of the provinces, and they show cause of death and where the child is buried. So, there are no missing children. Now, there are some records that are missing in the sense that over the course of 150 years, sometimes not everything gets kept, but basically you can see what was going on. And once streptomycin was discovered, then the death rate cratered phenomenally. Now, sadly, occasionally a kid would die. There'd be accidents, skating on thin ice. Different things can happen over the course of 150 schools over 150 years. There's going to be some tragic accidents, but there's no mass disappearance of children. So much of the book is, kind of prosaic, looking at the documentary evidence about these claims of unmarked graves and missing children. Another claim is that children were forced to attend. Well, again, this doesn't hold water. Indian children were not required to attend any school until 1920, an amendment to the Indian Act at that time. Prior to that, all attendance was voluntary. And after 1920, attendance at a residential school was required only if there was no day school convenient location.
To bring it back, Tom, to the issues that sort of have come from you raising these points, is that people are not willing to engage in a debate on the facts. They're not willing to engage in a debate on the merits, because I mean, you're a political scientist by training, and you have quite a lengthy career in academia. I mean, I would assume that your hope would be that you put a book like this out, and if people dispute it, they publish their own book, they publish their own response. And we're seeing now increasingly that people don't want to do that. Instead, they say, you know, how dare you? And without actually arguing with a single premise or conclusion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very true. It's sad. The contributors to the book are, people whose careers involve dealing with facts, retired professors in various fields like history or political science or sociology, lawyers, judges, journalists. That's the common denominator for almost all the contributors, is a focus on fact. And that's what we've tried to do in the book. But what's happening at Cornell is a refusal to look at facts and just to try and shout down the book before anybody gets a chance to read it.
So, well, I'm glad that it's been beneficial on the sales front at least. So a bit of a Pyrrhic victory for the council in terms of winning there. Well, I appreciate you straining your voice to join us today, Tom. Always good to talk to you. Drink some nice honey and lemon tea or something, and okay, hopefully you recover. But appreciate your time as always.
Okay. Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right. And by the way, I just read Pivot or Pirouette by Tom Flanagan, which I picked up at a conference last year. And I believe he signed it. I got him to, he signed it for me, which was quite nice. And this was a book, not a new book, but about the 1993 election, which was a rather pivotal one in Canadian politics. It was the election that brought Kim Campbell's Progressive Conservatives down to just two seats and saw the Reform Party just absolutely explode onto the scene. And I referenced it a little bit in my own book, which is coming out, which is about Pierre Poilievre, called Pierre Poilievre, A Political Life, the first so far biography of the Conservative Party of Canada leader. That's coming out on May 28th. You can get details online about that. It's on Amazon, Indigo. Actually, Indigo has it on sale right now. So Indigo didn't carry my last book on store shelves, so we had a bit of a negative relationship there, but they seem to be enthusiastic about this one. So if you have already pre-ordered it, thank you very much. Hopefully you enjoy it when it comes. That does it for us for today. We will be back in just 23 hours and 15 minutes with more of Canada's most irreverent talk show. Thank you, God bless, and good day to you all.
Thanks for listening to The Andrew Lawton Show. Support the program by donating to True North at www.tnc.news.